you. Thank you very much for coming out on a chilly evening. Especially thank you to Dr. Germani for organizing this series of talks this year, beginning last year with a talk by Jay Winter, which I will be trying to take issue with. If anyone was there, I will take issue with a few things that he said. Now, we were asked to consider whether World War I was a turning point in history, so I had to be pretentious and use the word singularity rather than turning point. And my basic answer will be yes, it was in some ways a turning point, but in other ways, some kind of commonly understood ways, it wasn't so much of a turning point. I'll be looking at four different ideas about World War I, and I'm going to apologize in advance. We've been given the rigorous task of saying things in 25 minutes, so I apologize if I am abbreviated about these things. The first idea I'm going to look at is whether maybe World War I was just normal, whether it was just business as usual in the world. Or was it, secondly, some kind of turning point, some kind of leap to a new plateau of bloody violence that gave us history's bloodiest century, as some people say? Or was it maybe just a temporary detour, thirdly, an anomaly? An upsurge in warfare and violence, but really something that was anomalous to the more peaceful trend of history. And fourthly, was it maybe a turning point in war aversion? Maybe was it a time when people started turning against war? So those are the four ideas I'm going to look at and try and see if any of them make any sense today. And firstly, the idea of normality. And the basic idea here is that, great powers, that's what they do. They clash. There's nothing to prevent them doing it. They've always been doing it for centuries. They're still doing it. Maybe it was just a normal occurrence. We can't say anything more than that. It's tragic, but just normal. And so the rise of the French, I hope you can see this okay. This is not the biggest screen in on campus, but this depicts Napoleon and William Pitt dividing up the world. The rise of the French gave us a clash of great powers a century before 1914. Then the rise of Germany, well, that gave us certain perturbations in the 20th century, like a couple of world wars, but not really a very different situation. Then we got the clash of the Americans and the Russians in the Cold War, and now we are getting another one, maybe, so say some people. This is just history going through a recurrence. There's nothing unusual about World War I. So says that idea. Except there is one problem with this particular idea, which is that since the last World War, we've been in an anomalous situation. We haven't had any more great power wars. The great powers may have had frictions and rivalries during the Cold War. There may be new frictions and rivalries with the rise of China. There probably will be, but that doesn't mean to say they'll be fighting another world war over it. We've had a period of peace among the great powers for 70 years. So that seems like a major blow to this idea, in my way of thinking. The second idea I want to look at is whether the outbreak of war led to a turning point in violence. And this is where I want to take issue with some of the things that Jay Winter talked about last October. One version of this idea is that modern capitalism somehow turned rotten from the inside, that capitalism turned reactionary, that modernity itself turned out to be a complete failure, and that the awful bloody killing of the of World War I, which then led to World War II, proves that. That somehow it ushered us into a new epoch in history marked by nothing less than bloodshed itself. And of course, the trenches are a great symbol of that. This is an aerial picture of the Allied trenches and the German trenches. All those little pock marks you can see are the craters left by shells. And I don't know if you can see, but the German trenches are built much better than the Allied trenches. That's because the Germans, they built their trenches to stay. The Allies thought that, well, they were just, after the next offensive, they'd be rolling along and they wouldn't need their trenches anymore. Actually, trench warfare isn't strictly, totally a turning point of World War I. It was the common way of doing sieges for centuries. Besieging a city, the besiegers built trenches around the city. So this was like a giant siege, really. Another turning point, some people say, and this was emphasized by Jay Winter, is that somehow World War I gave us weapons of mass destruction. And this is a picture of gas being let loose on the Western Front. Chemical weapons, of course, they didn't call them weapons of mass destruction back in World War I, but that's what they're now called. And here's a picture of some troops blinded by tear gas. And here's a picture of a Canadian soldier with some of the awful burns that the troops got from the gas. It blistered their skin. And I'm pretty sure that Jay Winter showed that particular picture. But there is a severe problem with this idea that somehow chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction, were a step on the road to something fierce and worse than we'd ever seen before, which is this: less than 1% of the deaths in World War I were caused by gas. Less than 1%. The whole of the British Army lost only 6,000 soldiers due to gas. That's a rounding error in the deaths. Actually, after the war, some writers argued that the use of gas was a humane weapon because it only temporarily incapacitated the people who were affected. After all, millions of troops came back from the war having had an arm or a leg blown off. Well, if they were affected by gas, they were put in hospital for a while, then they recovered, and then they were fine. So maybe it was even. Maybe that was true. Maybe it was more human. And the reason less than 1% of the deaths in World War I were caused by gas is this picture. There's a very simple defense against gas. Just put on a gas mask. That sort of thing will not defend you from a giant steel shell coming into your trench, but it will defend you against gas. So, all this talk nowadays about weapons of mass destruction really is overdone, I think. And in World War I, they were weapons of minor destruction. So that wasn't that much of a turning point. What about genocide? Jay Winter mentioned this. Maybe it was a genocide. Some people have said, well, the Armenian massacres in Turkey led to the Holocaust. Without the Armenian massacres, somehow the Holocaust couldn't have happened. It was the Armenian massacres. It was because Hitler saw the Turks getting away with the Armenian massacres that he thought he could get away. I don't buy that for a minute. And the reason is simply, there's nothing new, unfortunately, about genocides. They are ancient. Absolutely nothing new about them. The Armenian massacres and that they weren't a new thing. So that really wasn't that much of a turning point. Total war, meaning the mobilization of a whole population for war, even people on the home front urged to buy, in this case, victory bonds, or to waste not, want not. And these are both Canadian posters from World War I. Yes, in some ways that was a turning point, but there were earlier wars where civilian populations were severely affected. It's not true that World War I
was the first to really affect civilian populations.
I think World War I can be blamed for setting us on the road to totalitarianism, though. And here's where a lot of the bloodshed of the 20th century comes from. Because Hitler fought in the trenches. There he is with his comrades in World War I uniforms. And of course, without World War I, we would not have had the Russian Revolution. Here's Lenin and Trotsky speaking to a crowd in 1920. Without World War I, Russia would not have collapsed, and Lenin wouldn't have had a chance to take over. So yes, definitely, World War I kind of set in train totalitarianism, but you can't simply say, well, World War I gave us totalitarianism. It didn't give us totalitarianism in the liberal countries, the countries that already were liberal. They continued being liberal. They didn't turn totalitarianism. It didn't somehow make those countries rotten from the inside. It was only a very partial kind of turn towards a more bloody century. So if you were to try to add all these things up, maybe you could say that the 20th century was history's bloodiest century. The trench warfare, the weapons of mass destruction, the total war, the genocide, the totalitarian dictators who went on to start World War II and then to create horrific massacres. Is it really true to say that the 20th century was history's bloodiest century, and was World War I the kind of stepping stone to begin that? Well, the answer is it depends on how you count the bodies, basically. There's two ways. You can either count it by death rate, that's to say deaths per population, or you can count it by total deaths. And the total deaths of the 20th century do make it history's bloodiest century. There's no doubt that more people were killed in wars and atrocities, mainly the two world wars and those bloody totalitarian dictators, than in any other century. But in terms of death rate, it really wasn't history's bloodiest century. Let me try to give some figures there. I tried to add up. It's a nasty business, but somebody has to do it. I tried to add up the total deaths in the 20th century due to wars and atrocities. So adding up two world wars plus three evil dictators, that's Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, that gives us, well over 100 million deaths, maybe up to 150 million. Add in the other wars and massacres of the century, and you could get up to, if you're generous, about 200 million or so. So that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. And these are the top six really worst events of the 20th century. World War II, around about 55 million dead. Mao, Stalin, World War I, the Russian Civil War, and the Chinese Civil War. Those are the worst events. And lots of those are indirectly owe their origins to World War I. Many of them wouldn't have happened without World War I. But if you cast your net a bit wider and you start to try and look at the similar things, with the worst wars and atrocities in history as a whole, well, you could try to add them up by actual deaths, and World War I comes out top there. But there's some other challengers like Genghis and others. But if you adjust those deaths by population, and you remember that Genghis's conquests in the 1200s happened at a time when the population was tiny compared to the 20th century. If you adjust those to 20th century populations, Genghis's conquests, the Mongol conquests, come out to something nearly 300 million dead as a result of that. In other words, if he'd been on his rampages in the 20th century, that would have been the death toll. The fall of the Ming, a huge death toll in absolute terms, adjusted for 20th century population, something over 100 million. Timurleng, similar. It's only then that you get to World War I, and the 30 Years' War, which saw huge civilian casualties, something like 7 million total deaths, but adjusted for 20th century deaths, adjusted to a 20th century rate, perhaps something over 30 million, turns out to be worse than World War I. So World War I actually comes pretty far down on the list of the worst wars and atrocities of all time, when you adjust for population. So I have to say that we have to bear that in mind. So in conclusion, it depends on how you count it. If you count actual deaths, it was terrible. If you count the death rate, it makes it seem not quite so bad. What about an anomaly then? Was it maybe a blip in the decline of war? I know some people are going to say that I must be off my rocker talking about the decline of war. Don't we see wars happening everywhere? Isn't there bloodshed around the world? Well, actually, in many ways, there is a decline of war. We haven't seen one of these, have we? Those mushroom clouds that everyone was fearing for decades never actually happened, did they? So we have not seen an atomic war. We haven't seen another world war. We haven't seen another great power war. We've seen almost no interstate wars, that's to say wars from government between governments. We just don't see those very much anymore. The last really significant one was the Iran-Iraq war back in the 1980s. We do see civil wars, it's true. We definitely do see civil wars, but actually, by some counts, we don't see as many as we used to. So even civil wars seem to be on the decline. This is an attempt to tot up the year-by-year death toll, the year-by-year death toll of during the 20th century. So maybe you can see, I hope those at the back can see, that during World War I, which is this one, and that's World War II there, the annual death toll gets up to about 4 million a year. So over 4 years or so, that gives us the total death toll of World War I. Estimates vary between 10 and 15 million. World War II manages to double that rate. It's up to about 8 million a year over 5 years or so. Here are the Nazis. This one here is the Russian Civil War. Total death toll around 9 million. Death toll is up to about 2 million a year with that one. The yellow one here is China under Mao. That's a significant death toll too. And this greenish one, the Soviet flag, is Stalin. So those were the biggies. But note the overall pattern. It's not a leap to a new stage of violence in the world. It's a kind of a couple of big blips, isn't it? It's a couple of big temporary upsurges that then fall away. I mean, if World War I had been this new stage of history that gave us nothing but bloodshed, this year, 1925, in which there are virtually no deaths, couldn't really have happened, could it? See, it seems to me there's a sort of a normality level, and then there are these blips.
What's the spike at 1970-75?
Just after 1970, that would be the genocide in Bangladesh, in East Pakistan. That's when the Pakistanis started massacring the East Pakistanis, as was, as concerns. That looks to me like an anomaly.
A blip.
I know it sounds somehow demeaning to say that the World War One with all these casualties was somehow just a blip, a temporary reversal. But that's what the data looks like to me. So I think there's a lot of truth in that interpretation, that it was an anomaly. What about it being a turning point in war aversion? By war aversion, I mean dislike of war. Not pacifism, which is total aversion to war, but reluctance to go to war, dislike of war. I'd say that there's some truth to this, because it looks like an unusual war to me in which even the victors, the French, the British, the Americans, turned against it. Even the victors started to think that this was a gigantic, colossal mistake. That looks to me like something new in history. For example, I'll just give a couple of examples of this war aversion. And this is something that I, by the way, agree with Jay Winter. He did mention this, and I agree with him. One thing is that a century before, the French had been involved in the Revolutionary and their Napoleonic Wars, and they built themselves this gigantic and now world-famous Arc de Triomphe, Arch of Triumph. Triumphant, glorious arch. Why didn't they build a new Arch of Triumph after World War I? After all, they won the war. They beat their enemy. They were triumphant. They were victorious. Why didn't they build this another new glorious monument to their triumph, as they'd done a century before? Why instead did they build these things? Lots and lots of cemeteries and memorials. That's what got built, not triumphant arches, but memorials. That looks to me like people, at least in the liberal countries, in France and England and North America, just had changed their mind about war. Not true elsewhere. In the non-liberal countries, they retained the older view of war. Serbia was the country that lost the most per capita in World War I. That's to say, more Serbians were killed in World War I per capita than any other nation. And some people say, well, you started it. It was the Serbians who started it by assassinating the Archduke. Maybe that's some kind of cosmic justice. But the point is, you don't see this war aversion arising in somewhere like Serbia, even though they lost per capita a lot more people than the liberal nations. The liberal nations have changed their outlook. Another example of this war aversion brings us to today, because a century later, today, 2014, I do not see people giving talks and writing books about the victory, that it was a triumph, that the Allies won. I see books called Catastrophe, The War That Ended Peace, Cataclysm, A World Undone. I've just looked through a few books, recent books, about World War I, and that's the titles of them. That's how World War I is now remembered. Margaret Macmillan is probably the best known writer. Her recent book about World War I is called The War That Ended Peace. actually. It didn't really end peace, did it? Peace came back. But that seems to me to signify this war aversion that we have in the liberal nations. So, was it normality? Yeah, in some ways it was normality, but that normality seems to be drifting away into a new normality, perhaps. Was it a turning point in violence? No, not as much, at least, as some people have said. Was it an anomaly? Yes, in some ways it was an anomaly. Was it a turning point in war aversion? Yes, I think it was. And there I'll end it.